Hi, my name's Fiona. I'm an author and a psychologist. I've spent most of my career speaking to people in depth about their lives, trying to work out what makes them tick. I absolutely love hearing about people's upbringings, backgrounds. Everyone is unique and fascinating. And now I'm so excited to be able to share some of these amazing stories with you. Welcome to episode 3 of Dot to Dot, Behind the Person. This week, I'm thrilled to be able to share the airwaves, if that's what they are, excuse the pun, with the CEO of Dot Martins, Kenny Wilson. The first time I met Kenny was over the phone, but even though I couldn't see him face to face, I found him really engaging, so hopefully you will today when you listen. He's really quick, very savvy, and just a genuinely good bloke. It was a number of years ago that I met him, but it actually wasn't until we recorded this podcast that I learned that he'd been en route to becoming a professional footballer as a lad. We talk about how life took him down the route it did, his time at Levi's, he spent a long time at Levi's learning his craft as a leader, as it were, who influenced him, how they influenced him, and how he's grown into the person he is today. Hope you enjoy listening. So today I'm in the company of Kenny Wilson, who's someone that I've had the privilege of working with a bit on and off over the last few years. Kenny, do you want to tell people who you are, what you do?
Okay, I'm a 53-year-old Scottish bloke, and I'm currently the CEO of Dr. Martens.
Dr. Martens, an iconic brand, isn't it? And what I love about it is the feeling just in the office is that it reflects the culture. I remember when you were at Cath Kidston and when I first started doing some work with you, you said you need to come into the offices because you need to feel the culture so you understand it. And I very strongly believe that as well. And the first time I came to these offices, I was on crutches.
I remember.
People were so helpful and friendly, genuinely. And I'd been in London all day and I'd been buffeted around and I just thought, wow, that's a genuinely nice place. But it's got a great vibe, hasn't it, here?
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I take no credit for that. I think that, you know, one of the things that attracted me to come here nearly 2 years ago was the people and the values of the company. Mm-hmm. The team had already put together something which was called On the Record, and it looks like a record, and on there's the values of the company, and that's a focus on what's called the fundamentals and then the stuff that sets us apart. And people really live that at Dr. Martens, and it's what makes it such a super place to work.
Yeah, everyone's incredibly helpful, friendly, all those things. But there's also a slightly edgy vibe about it.
Yeah, the brand's about rebellious self-expression. And, you know, most people who come and work here have been Dr. Martens wearers. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be independent thinkers. They tend to be people who stand up for things that they believe in. So the people who work here are very representative of the brand values.
Mm. Yeah, and because you know I'm passionate about whoever I work with, whatever brand it is. And when I was in San Francisco, I don't think I've told you this, actually, we went into the Dr. Martens shop. I wanted to get some Dr. Martens, but long story short, I didn't, to do with my ankle injury. But the guy that ran that shop sat with us for ages. Knew anything about Dr. Martens. Sat with us, told us who he was, how much he loved the company. He'd moved from another area in the States, how supported he felt, how passionate he was about it, how passionate he was about his staff. And I think that's a true reflection. If you can go to somewhere in the middle of nowhere, well, San Francisco is not the middle of nowhere, go into a shop and hear what the people that work there say about the brand. So it's not just here in head office in Camden Town where it's all very funky.
Yeah, no, I think we've got, you know, amongst the most passionate store teams that I've ever worked with in my career. And again, that's because people generally come to the brand after having been a fan of the brand. And I think that makes such a difference.
Yeah. Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Aberdeen in the north of Scotland. So I had with my mum and my dad and my older sister. Mm-hmm. Quite relatively humble beginnings. Grew up in a council housing estate but a pretty secure upbringing. You know, so it wasn't like I'm going to sit here and say I had some massively underprivileged upbringing because I didn't, but started from relatively humble origins.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you end up where you are today? Because clearly that's a...
Yeah, it's been a relatively, it's been a long journey, obviously, to the job I've got today. I actually started out life thinking I was going to be a professional footballer.
Did you? So, I never knew that.
So I was a schoolboy signing at Aberdeen when they were a really good team, when Alex Ferguson was the manager. And I thought that that's where my career would be. What I always wanted to be. I always wanted to be a football player. And unfortunately for me, I got released from Aberdeen when I was 16. Which was a big blow, because at that time they were one of the top two teams in Europe, and got given the opportunity to go and have trials with Dundee, to sign for Dundee, who were a Scottish Premiership team, and chatted to my dad about it, who'd been a failed professional footballer, and decided that I was going to stop and go to university instead. So
you know, that's a massive decision to make, isn't it, when you've had your identity, I imagine, so entwined with that.
Yeah, I spent all my time, growing up, probably either playing football or reading. There were two things I was really interested in. And, where I grew up, if you're going to be successful, that you either had to get an education or you had to be good at sport. I mean, they were really the drivers. And my first love and my first passion was football. So that's what I thought I wanted to be. And, when you're good at school and then you're good at district level and so forth, you believe that it's possible.
I think you have to, don't you?
But I learned lots of great stuff from it. You know, it teaches you about looking after yourself, it teaches you about discipline, it teaches you about preparation. So I never regret any of it. Probably the only thing that I do different now as an adult is I didn't kick a ball for 4 years after I stopped playing properly. So, I probably missed out on 4 years of enjoyment, but back then I was quite definite. Probably a lot more definite than I am today. So I just made a decision to say, that's it, the football thing's over. And I went to university, and when people at university asked me if I wanted to go and try out for the university team or play, I just said, no, I don't play football anymore. So I still continue to watch, and I've spent my whole career going and supporting Aberdeen. Yeah, I'm still a season ticket holder. I still go most weeks, not every week, but most weeks. I'm going on Saturday. Yeah, still with my daughter and my friend and his son that... it's a way of disengaging from work for me. I like to go to the football because I don't think about work when I'm at football.
We went to the rugby, the England, Ireland game on Sunday, and it's just, I haven't been to a football match for ages. That feeling being amongst the crowd and the roar and the singing and is mesmerising in a way. It does take you out of yourself, out of your thoughts. I guess it's quite primal, really, isn't it? It's being amongst other people who are passionately engaged with the same thing as you.
For me, it's about many things. It's about identity. It's about roots. It's about where I grew up. It's about going to football with friends that I've known for a long time that they're not interested if I'm a CEO. So it's irrelevant. And that's really nice because, I'm just their mate and they want to go to the football. And for me and my daughter, it was something that she came home when she was 7 years old and said, I want to go to football, Dad. And I thought she'd go for 2 or 3 games. And, she's been a season ticket holder now for 14 years. So it's just something we do and I do with my friends. And it's a massive distraction from work. So it's super.
So that's quite... So if you think back to 16, that was a massive decision, though. And it's interesting, you responded a bit like... My brother responded to... He was a music scholar. And then he stopped school, stopped music. Just didn't pick up instruments, didn't play them. Sort of like, if I'm not going to do it, I'm really not going to do it. I'm going to disengage from it and move away from it.
I can remember it vividly. I can remember the night that I came home after being released. I remember talking to my mum and dad about it and being really upset. And I remember deciding that if I can't do it at the highest level, then I'm not going to do it. So it was a very conscious choice as a kid to say, nah, I don't want to go and do the trials with Dundee. I'd much rather focus on getting my exams right now and getting into university and kind of getting an education. And then I didn't really know, when you go through university, I didn't know really what I wanted to do. I just wanted to get the benefit of going to university.
Well, not many people do, I think. That's what's interesting.
Yeah.
So when I'm profiling people, it's interesting, the number of people, they're sort of apologetic that they didn't know what they wanted to do. Hardly anyone, unless you are going to be a professional footballer or an athlete, hardly anyone really knows what they want to do. Or if you've been sort of I think, brought up to believe through family that you need to be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that.
I mean, for me, nobody in my family before my sister and I had ever gone to university.
Yeah.
So really all my parents wanted for me was that we both got an education.
And you enjoyed reading?
Yeah, so I did English and psychology at university, and you know, when I talk to people now and they say, you know, why did you do that? Or why have you done the jobs you've done? And I've always said, do things you enjoy. Because I think if you do things you enjoy in life, you're better at them.
Absolutely.
And also life is there to be enjoyed and to be lived. So if you're not doing things you enjoy, go and do something else.
But it sounds obvious, and yet so many people, I mean, including me, will get taken down a route of things that we don't necessarily fully enjoy, because we feel obliged or because that's what life expects of us. And it's something we have to remind ourselves, I think, and it's really important for kids to know that. Do what you enjoy. From the psychological perspective, I've always really enjoyed talking to you about psychology and how that works. So you've clearly brought it with you throughout your career, that interest and curiosity in people and behaviour and why things happen the way they do and why people behave the way they do.
Yeah, for sure, because I think that just what I've learned across my career, it's not always the intellectually smartest people who are the most successful, because you get things done through other people.
Yeah.
And therefore, being able to work with other people, to communicate effectively with other people, to understand other people's drivers and motivations, I found that those things have been more important to me. I can only talk for myself, but those things have been more important to me than whether I'm the smartest kid in the room, because there's always going to be somebody that's smarter than you.
Mm. Yeah, well, obviously, talking to someone who believes that quite strongly as well, because I believe in all the behavioural side of stuff. I would also say the best leaders that I have worked with in whatever way, and again, this is my bias probably, will understand psychology. It is fundamentally what's life, isn't it? We are social beings. I believe that we should put a lot more emphasis on that at school as well, because it's about equipping children for life, not just for being able to answer tests.
Yeah. I think I've also been extremely fortunate that, you know, I spent a huge chunk of my career at Levi's, and they invested in me and my development, and gave me a coach back in, the 90s, end of the 90s, so probably more than 20 years now. And that was incredibly valuable for me to understand myself better, because I believe that as a leader, the first step is being able to lead yourself. If you can't lead yourself, you can't lead other people. Mm. And that was enormously beneficial in helping me to get to where I am now.
And do you still see him?
Her.
Why did I think it was him?
I've had two coaches in my career. One who helped me in the mid-90s when I sort of took on my first big leadership job at Levi's with what felt like a big team at the time. It was only 16 people, but it felt like a lot because it was the first big step. And then when I became marketing director of Northern Europe at Levi's in the end of the 90s, I think sort of 98, I got a coach that I've still got today, and I spoke to her last week. I don't see it as frequently now as I used to, because I've learned a lot more tools and techniques. You know, at the beginning I would see her every 3 weeks, and then it went to every month and so forth. But I think, you know, the best sports people in the world still need help. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I feel that having the chance to talk about what I'm working on and so forth, when I hear myself saying it out loud, I find it, you know, just incredibly beneficial to actually help you move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything like it, whether someone just sits there and listens or whether they're offering you advice. Saying it out loud is hugely helpful. So Levi's was quite what's the main part of your career, really, wasn't it, to date?
Yeah, I mean, I mean after university, I joined Clark Shoes in the K's division, did that for a short period of time. Then I actually went and did a graduate conversion course in finance, not because I ever wanted to be a financial bloke, but I could just see early on that, you know, you had to understand numbers.
Yeah.
So I went and did that for a year, which is where I met my first wife. And then from there I joined what was the Burton Group in buying and merchandising, and ended up on ladies' trousers and jeans. And then from there, I went to Levi's in 1990 and spent the next 19 years of my career there. So, yeah, I mean, Levi's was incredibly formative for me. It gave me huge opportunities to learn. They invested a lot in me. They put me into different jobs. They put me on the High Potential Mentoring Program. I mean, there were so many things that I will always be grateful to that business for, because it was just so focused on developing people. And I was lucky enough to have 19 years of it.
And within those 19 years, what would you say the highlights were?
Gosh, there were so many brilliant bits. I think probably when I got my first UK leadership job, where I was retail and franchise director for the UK, mm-hmm. and we were the best performing part of the business, that was phenomenal. In 98, I was made part of the European brand leadership team, working for a guy called Robert Hansen that I'm still in touch with now. And that was an incredible period of really focusing on brand innovation and brand soul. And then when Robert left and went back to the United States, I got made brand president of Europe at 34, which was, at the time, I don't know if it still is, but at the time was the youngest brand president around the world, which I remember being absolutely elated, and then probably about 6 months later realizing I probably got the job a bit soon.
In what sense?
Because I think I was a functional expert, and I think I knew a lot about product, I knew a lot about marketing, I knew a lot about retail, but I hadn't really fundamentally understood that, what does the boss really do? The boss gets people clear on priorities, the boss picks the right people and gets them to work together. And mm-hmm. if you can do those three things, you can pretty much be the boss of many things. But you've got to go through that experience of learning that, the HR stuff isn't an add-on to your job, that is your job.
Yeah.
Picking the right people, putting them in the right jobs, getting them focused on the right things, and then getting them to work together. That formula I've applied everywhere else since, and it's been generally pretty successful in terms of getting results.
It's not an easy thing to do, though, is it?
No, but I think that it gets you clear on what you're trying to do. When I came into Dr. Martens, I inherited a team who'd had no boss for nearly a year. They're very capable people, and they knew what they were doing, but they just needed a bit of guidance, and they needed to be helped to collaborate and communicate together more effectively. And when you're not trying to do their jobs, when you know what your own job is, mm-hmm. and you don't dive into the bits that you know, because that's always the challenge.
That's what I see time and again with people who are very, very competent. It's that piece about letting go. And, you can describe it as letting go of the detail, but it's actually letting go of almost everything and then having a light touch until there's an issue and you dive in and you solve that issue and then you come back out again. Again, it comes down to that understanding people, understanding their motivations. Communication is absolutely critical, isn't it? If there isn't clear communication.
So, I think you raise an interesting point, which, everyone always thinks when you're the boss, you've got total control. But the reality is control is an illusion. Because whilst we're sitting here talking right now, the team in Asia Pacific are just going to bed and they've worked all day, and the team in North America are just getting up and they're going to work, and I have absolutely no control on what they're doing. All I've got control on is, did I pick the right presidents to run those divisions, and have I agreed the right priorities with those presidents?
Yeah,
and that's all I've really got control on. So trying to control the detail is irrelevant. What you have to control is the things that really make a difference.
But there's also that respect for you as their leader. I mean, that makes a massive difference, doesn't it? Because if you respect your leader and you agree with the direction that that leader's pulling in, then it means that it's much easier to then let go and allow people to get on with things, because they have faith in you, you have faith in them, and there's that mutual trust.
Yeah, I think I learned this in my Levi's career from Paul Mason, who's now our chairman here at Dr. Martens. When he came in to be my boss at Levi's, in the early 2000s, he sat all of us down on the leadership team and talked about what he wanted to accomplish. And then he said, there's two doors. There's a green door and a red door. And the green door is for people who want to come with me and follow that vision. And the red door is for the people who don't. And it was really illustrative to me as someone who was still in their 30s at the time, saying, okay, this guy's trying to get alignment. And I remember saying to him, okay, I've heard your views. I want to go over a weekend and have a think about it. And then I came back in on the Monday and said to him, I can agree with those four things, but I don't agree with you on this point. And And he said, okay, let's talk it out. And mm-hmm. we talked it out, and by the end, we both went through a mutual green door. And it was a really big lesson for me, because he'd come in as a new leader, and he wasn't trying to tell me how to do my job, but he was very clear about the direction in which he wanted to go. And I think when you get that level of clarity, you know where you stand and you know how you want to operate.
Yeah, and then hand off the accountability to the individual.
Yeah, because if you want to do other people's jobs, then why have you got them?
But it's a really hard thing to do, I think, isn't it, that letting go, especially when you're very good at something yourself, is being able to say, I know I can do that really well, and they might not be able to do it as well as me, but I'm going to let them do it.
Or they might do it better. And that's the other interesting thing that, again, you learn as you get older.
Well, that's something that's nice about you, because I think you have that level of humility as well. But
I think especially when you're in my job, I mean, I've got a team of functional experts that work for me. Some of them are generalists, but, you know, my chief legal counsel is going to know way more about legal matters than I'll ever know, and the chief financial officer knows way more about finance than I'll ever know. So therefore, the job of the leader is to have the right questions. Mm. You don't need to have the answer. And I never worry about having the answer. It doesn't bother me at all. I'm not here to be the smartest. I'm here to ensure we're the most successful.
Yeah. And there's a level of comfortable confidence in that from you, I think.
Yeah, I think as you get older, you're well, I can talk for myself. As I've got older, I'm fine with who I am. You know, I'm really quite fine with it. And therefore, you know, as I say, I'm not here to try and be the smartest. I just think when you get to the point where everybody wants to try and be the smartest in the room, invariably you're not successful. I think it's more about looking for the smartest idea in the room and then getting everyone aligned behind that. And that's what I'm more interested in.
Part of talking about this is who have been the biggest influences in your life. And you've mentioned your mum, dad, sister, and I haven't necessarily said they're the biggest influences, but the fact that you've brought them up suggests they are in some way your daughter, friends, coaches.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really lucky. I mean, one of the things I'm really conscious of is that I learn from people. You know, throughout my career, when I've looked back on the sort of big moments, I can relate them to people. And I've always thought of my career like a golf bag, so you need different clubs.
Yeah.
And I've just learned from different people. But if I sort of rewind, my mum and dad were probably, you know, extremely formative in helping me form my values when I was young.
Yeah.
You know, where I grew up, it was all about hard work to get out of where you are.
Yeah.
So there was a real kind of, you know, I don't know, 1970s Scottish working class thing about, you know, you need to better yourself. And as I said earlier, bettering yourself was about getting out of where you grew up. So that gives you drive, it gives you determination, it gives you high standards. Some of those things I've had to unlearn as well as I've got older.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, I remember my dad when I was a kid saying, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I've always had really high drive. But, you know, that, you know, some days you had to wash your car to perfection, you had to cut your grass to perfection, all these things. And it comes to a point that doesn't work. The harder you work, the luckier you get. Because when you're more senior, you've got to be well rested, and it's not just about how many hours you work. So what I learned from my parents, I wouldn't be here today if I didn't have those values instilled within me. But at a certain point, it became self-limiting.
Yeah.
And therefore, I had to break those down with my coach. And I don't really believe in rules anymore, because I think rules are too definitive. I believe in guiding principles.
Yeah.
Whereas my mum and dad hammered rules into me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was extremely formative in my early years. And then, you know, through my career, I've had various people that I've learned from without a doubt. I mean, I remember, you know, in my early years at Levi's, I got selected for the Global High Potential program, and I was partnered up with a UK general manager, an American lady called Jan Westfall, and, you know, she taught me about having a broader vision beyond my own job at the time, because I was a kind of product manager in the UK, and I got to spend a certain number of days a month with her. You know, I saw how much time she invested in me, so that was about giving back to other people. And you know, I mentioned earlier I worked for a guy called Robert Hansen when I got my first big European leadership job. I learned a lot from Robert. I worked for Paul Mason, who's now our chairman at Levi's. I learned a lot from Paul.
Because over the years, you've mentioned some of the learnings that you've gathered from Paul.
Yeah, I've worked with Paul three times now. He was my boss at Levi's, then he was my chairman at Cath Kidston, he's been my chairman at Dr. Martin's.
I've still not met him.
Have you not? Yeah, no, it's just one of those relationships that's worked. you know, I told you that I had Dora Green, Dora conversations. It was quite a hard start when we first met each other, but over the years, you know, there's been a lot of respect built there, and I've learned, I learned a lot from Paul. I learned a lot from my coach, Elsa. You know, she's helped me become a better version of myself and probably a happier human being, if I'm really honest. If I'm brutally honest, that's the, you know, getting to a point where, you know, I'm having a lovely time doing this. Because I'm very good at being able to endure stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that fits with what you, partly what, you know, your football training, what you're brought up with your parents. And I think a mindset that in our generation was you work as hard as you can. And it's only now that we're realising actually that leads to burnout. It doesn't lead to optimal performance. But there's also getting happy. It's not just about slogging yourself. I think we all need someone to remind us of that.
I've got better at reminding myself of it. If you look at children and you look at the joy of children, and you just watch them and they're having a lovely time, and you know, some days I say to myself, "Am I having a lovely time?" And it's the way that it reminds me of saying, if you're having too many days that you're not having a lovely time, then it's time to go and do something else.
Yeah.
But I would never have thought like that 30 years ago. You know, 30 years ago it was about I need to strive, I need to get on. I wouldn't say I've lost my driving energy. I just think I'm more balanced in how I apply my energy these days.
Do you think that strive is almost necessary early on in career, though?
I think it's hard to be successful without drive. And I think, you know, there's levels in that are extremes. You know, I've looked back many times and you know, people say to me, oh, you know, your ex-wife, was she a dragon? And, you know, is that why you ended up getting divorced? And no, I mean, I was extremely single-minded. And, you know, I took international postings without discussing it with her, things I'd never do now. But I was so single-minded about the need to progress. And, you know, again, with years of coaching, I know that a lot of that was down to, you know, fear of not wanting to end up where I came from.
Yeah.
So I wanted to end up in a different place, and therefore I didn't know when to dial the drive down, because it was always about, well, if I don't do well and I don't do better, then I might end up back there. Now, the reality is you get to a certain point where it's obvious that you're not going to end up back there, but you know, fear, internal fear like that is irrational. It's not rational.
And it's also, it's very connected with one of your values that you were brought up with, so it's difficult to let go of those sorts of things.
It's really hard.
Do you find that it's not just your coach, but it's also your wife and your daughter who sort of nudge you back on course if you're getting too?
My wife's really driven too. Mm-hmm. So my wife grew up in a council housing estate in Birmingham and has got many of the same values of hard work, drive, didn't want to end up living in a council housing estate in Birmingham.
Yeah.
So therefore, yeah, we're probably not the best at getting either of us to slow down. I think for me, that insight's come through coaching, and then it's come through just greater self-insight.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Sue and I are not the best at stopping each other working. We just tend to divide into different rooms within the house and work in separate places. So no, we're not. I wouldn't say we're very good at stopping each other working.
That sounds a bit like Chris and I. Although we're staying in the same room, we just don't talk to each other. And how about your daughter? Does she ever check you in, sort of like just say, Dad, you know, you're too busy or you're working too
hard? Yeah, I mean, she jokes sometimes and says, you know, what about a bit of self-care, which kind of feels very current. But she's also got quite a high work ethic as well. And I've tried not to put her under any pressure. But before my mum died, I remember my mum saying to me, you know, Abby is my daughter. Abby feels like she's got a lot to live up to, which I sometimes feel bad about. You know, you can't change what you've done. But my goal for her is that she's happy, not that she's successful, because you know, you can be happy without, you know, as my mum and dad would have said, getting on in life. What I want for Abby is happiness more than anything.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm with you on that. And to me, that is success.
Yeah.
If you can, obviously you need to have enough to be able to survive and to have the freedom. You know, I'm the same with my girls. I want them to be happy. And sometimes I worry that I'm not pushy enough with them because, you know, other parents are like, And I'm like, oh, I just want them to be happy. But it's hard to know what they're picking up on and what they're not, and B, what's right and what's wrong, and all the sort of the melting pot of things that influence someone when they're growing up, which you sort of talked about yourself.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the hardest thing I've ever encountered in my life was when Abby was deciding which university to go to.
Yeah.
And, you know, she'd applied for different ones, and she narrowed herself down at the end to she wanted to study business either at Edinburgh or Strathclyde. And for me, there wasn't a choice. I mean, it was obvious that Edinburgh's a high-class university and Strathclyde, it's a lower-standard university relative to Edinburgh. No disrespect to anybody who's gone to Strathclyde. And she was wrestling with it, and I went and got help from my coach, and I was like, I just want to tell her what to do, you know, which is what you do at work. And she helped me see that actually what I wanted was for Abby to make her own decisions in life.
Yeah.
And so I backed off and I didn't get involved in the decision, and I trusted that subliminally she hopefully picked up things from me that, you know, were good things, and then she decided what was important for her. And I reconciled myself with whether she picks Strathclyde or Edinburgh, I'll be happy because it'll be about her being happy and it'll be her choice.
Yeah.
And as she goes forward, she'll then not have to come to her dad. So I said to her, look, I'm here if you want me. If you want to discuss anything with me, you can, but it's your choice. And so I backed off and she chose Edinburgh, which I was really pleased about. But it was a big lesson for me in terms of if I want her to grow up and be a strong, independent woman on her own, it's not about her dad making decisions for her or dad influencing her. It's about her deciding what the right thing to do is. And that's more important to me.
It's hard though, isn't it?
It's the hardest thing I've ever done, much harder than work. Because work, you know, a lot of the times because I've been the boss, I'm in control of the final decision. And it's not the same. Work's important to me, but it's not as important as my daughter. So therefore, you know, to back out of a decision when you're used to being in an environment where you're often quite decisive, it's by far the hardest thing I've ever done.
And I think it's hard as well. I mean, just my eldest is 13, and every single week, every single month, you're having to adjust your parenting because suddenly you've got a teenager rather than a child. And you're describing the same sort of thing at the next evolution, as it were, when they become independent young women. But it's constant learning and evolution as a parent of, well, what's right, what's wrong now? Do I hold on tighter? Do I let go? What do I say? What don't I say? And I think there's so much emotion because we care so much about our children. People say to me, oh, you're a psychologist, poor, you know, poor. No. Believe me, I am no role model for parenting whatsoever. I just try my best. Just closing off, as a leader and as a great dad and as all those things, you're obviously a role model to other people. Do you ever think about that? Do you think about the influence and impact you're having on other people's lives?
I do think about a lot about my behaviour at work. You know, role model sounds quite, I don't know, grand. But I do think, you know, leaders cast a long shadow in terms of behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my behaviour influences other people in the company and the culture of the company. So I think every day before I come to work, I think a lot more about how I want to be rather than what I have to do.
Mm.
Because I think how leaders show up how they behave is extremely important for organisations. And you know, if I want to be a certain way, then I've got to get myself emotionally right to be like that all the time.
Yeah.
When I'm here, and I try to keep my emotional bandwidth pretty narrow, and I try to be curious, and I try to listen really well, and I try to be encouraging, and I try to be positive. So we try in our leadership programs here in terms of how we pass that message over at this point about thinking how you want to be. Most people get on the tube in the morning or get in their car and they think about their to-do list. I think it's much more important to think about how you want to be. And then as a dad, as I said, I don't try to be a role model for Abby because I think that Abby has to choose her own life. I try and exercise, I try and eat well, I try and, you know, show care, I try and do all those things that, you know, say this is where I'm at, but when you're 21, I think you've just got a different outlook in life to somebody who's 53, because, you know, 53, you think probably got 30 years left to live, and that gives you more perspective. When you're 21, you're not thinking about that.
No, but I think dad's always a role model. I know my dad was, and he still is, you know, even though he's not here anymore. I often refer to what he would have thought or what he would have done. Even though he, like you, wasn't sort of, he never told me what to do, but there's that love and respect there that I think means a daughter looks to their father for certain things. And what you've just said fits so perfectly with the talk I'm going to give next month, which I'm very pleased about.
What's that about?
It's the talk at London School of Economics, but it's about the book, basically. So it's fantastic that you finished on that. And this being aware of how you are and how you want to show up and the impact that we're having on other people the whole time. And that can be sort of letting a door close in someone's face or, you know, not smiling or smiling. And as a leader, it's magnified. Like you say, there's that long shadow that you cast. But I think just as anyone on the street during the day, the way we interact with other people, I don't think I know, it impacts their day.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, the version of that from my parents was always, you know, teach other people as you want to be treated yourself. And I've kind of modified that, but teach other people as you think they want to be treated, which is slightly different. But I think it's, you know, it's so much for me about being respectful of other people. You know, when you start your life from fairly humble origins, I don't think I'm better than anyone else. I'm just lucky that I've got the job I've got, and I'm lucky I've got the life I've got. So therefore, being respectful of other people is extremely important to me. You know, whether I'm walking down the street or whether I'm coming in here or, you know, whether I'm interacting with somebody on the tube in the morning, I think, you know, it's deep in my values around being respectful of others.
Yeah.
Something I really like. Passionately believe in it. I don't like it when, you know, when people come here for an interview, if they're not nice to one of the executive assistants on the way up, doesn't matter how nice they are to me, it tells you something about how they behave with people. And we're all of us here, you know, one of the things about Dr. Martin's is this is a pretty flat company. And, you know, we don't want people here that are up themselves. We want people who are humble enough and have got enough integrity that they want to work here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing I've found from my view of you, as it were, that's what I'm seeing, and that's what I've always seen, and that's partly why I very much enjoy your company.
Thank you.
And I'm so grateful for you talking today. Hopefully this will inspire some other people to on their journey, whether that's to a journey of happiness or a journey to CEO, whichever that might be, but some real words of wisdom there. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you, Penny.
Thanks, Una.
Kenny's respect for people, those around him, his curiosity about what's going on, you know, maybe it comes from his upbringing, maybe it comes from his career, his life, who knows exactly what it is, but overall it makes him into a really interesting person, someone who's great to be around, someone who it's nice to know, and I really hope you enjoyed listening to his story as much as I enjoyed speaking to him. Thanks for tuning in.